As a software engineer, chances are you've crossed paths with MongoDB at some point, whether you're building an app for millions of users or just figuring out your side hustle. It's the most popular non-relational database. MongoDB is intuitive and incredibly easy for development teams to use. Now, with MongoDB Atlas, you can take advantage of MongoDB's flexible document data model as a fully automated cloud service. MongoDB Atlas handles all the costly database operations and admin tasks that you'd rather not spend time on, like security, high availability, data recovery, monitoring, and elastic scaling. Try MongoDB Atlas for free today. Visit www.mongodb.com/cloud to learn more. That's mongodb.com/cloud. Hi, this is Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes. And today I'm talking with Lourdes Montano. She's a senior software engineer at RGA. How are you?
Very good. Nice to meet you.
Yeah, nice to chat with you. You've got a great video on YouTube that you spoke at Cascadia Fest in my area here in 2016. And you were talking about how to organize your learning process. And you're a developer and you do a lot of work in CSS. And it was interesting that you said how to organize your learning process in CSS. So you kind of thought about how one thinks and how one learns, and then you applied it to CSS.
Yeah, for me, it was always a very interesting, no matter if it's CSS or any other technology, but I usually focus on CSS. How's the learning process? Because you know that the technology has a very fast pace. It's like every 2-3 months, something new appears, something, a new technology, a new blog post, and you start feeling like you're kind of behind of it. And you're like, I want to be up to date. I want to be like the cool kid to write a tidy, clean CSS and using the latest technologies. And all the time there are things appearing, and you start feeling quite behind. And it's like the talk that I gave at Cascadia in 2016 was about how I dealt with anxiety and the pressure of the fast pace of the tech industry. It was more about talking about my feelings during my learning process, the ups and downs, because usually when you read a blog post or you see a talk or a new technology, everything is great, everything is perfect, but that takes a lot of work. So I had the need to talk about my journey about that because it's like I think that is like it happens to everyone, that it has ups and downs, and we don't learn from our failures too.
Yeah, and I appreciate that you call that out, that we can't learn everything, right? We can't know everything. Everything's moving so fast. But why do you think that we tell ourselves that we can? Why are we convinced? You know, we see someone speaking at a conference and we say, "Oh, they know everything. Oh, I suck. I'll never know everything." And we get all sad about that. Yes. We get all depressed about that.
Yeah. There is a constant pressure of learn the new things and keep all up to date with the latest stuff, like new frameworks, new platforms, new ideas on how to write code. In the moment, it was less SAS than if using BEM or RTCSS, for example, if it was better, even tabs or spaces were on the plate. Everything was just coming out. And whenever you think you got better at a certain methodology, a new one came out and you're like, oh, okay, and back to square zero again. And that's really a lot of pressure to learn new things, to spend all your time coding, to be the super developer. And that, at least in my case, it leads to a lot of anxiety. And so One day I was like, okay, this is, I'm really not enjoying this. So, but it's something that I really love doing. So how will I organize this so I can keep kind of up to date, but at the same time, knowing that I cannot know the 100% of the things, but at the same time, enjoy my job, which is actually what I love doing. So many times that happens that I was feeling mentally tired and hitting the wall while learning something and start saying, oh, this is not for me. I know, look at this person who did this new thing and I'm not very good at that, blah, blah, blah. And all that internal dialogue that we all have. But it's about understanding that learning to code is a process that never ends. It's not static and it changes and mutates every few months. So yeah, it was very interesting to me to start learning that. And since then I started to feel more, at least organized with a little bit more of peace of mind.
It's interesting that we seem to think that we would get our degree or we learn our, you know, we learn our technology and we think it's going to stay that way, and it simply doesn't. I think only the basics have stayed the same, but all the technologies that I used to work on when I started in school are all dead, except maybe C.
Yeah. It's a huge process. And then you finish school and you're like, oh, okay, I'm ready for the real world. Then you realize that you're not, and you have to keep learning. And this is something that I love about this profession, that you need to keep learning all the time, but at the same time, handle the pressure of that.
Yeah. And I also appreciate that you called out that I thought this was supposed to be fun. And then you get into something and you're like, I'm not enjoying myself anymore. I don't want to quit tech because of anxiety of having to try to learn everything, right? So you're applying very formal learning processes. You're basically attacking the problem with lists and organization. You said in your talk, I'm going on an adventure. Like, there's a formality to the way that you put this together.
Yeah, I have what I like to call a positive anxiety when I start a new project, and when they command me to do something new, that is like it's like the panic of the whiteboard, that you're like, oh, what I'm going to add in here? Will I be able to do it? Maybe I'm not going to be able to do it, but I always end up trusting myself, like comparing with previous situations, and I was always able to do it and learning with more effort, less effort, but it was always like that. It's like during the course of your life, we all have fears, fear of being rejected, fear of being criticized, fear of not knowing something that is obvious to everyone else. It happens a lot that someone is explaining something to you and they say, oh, this is super easy. And maybe for that person it's super easy, but if for me it's not easy, I'm going to say, oh, I'm not that good, so what's wrong with me? And for me, I try to organize, say, okay, no one, it's like we all start from scratch and we all help each other, so let's try to be patient. I know that it's true that sometimes you have a deadline and you really need to keep up to that, but it's good to start organizing. For example, when I have a big problem that I don't know how to solve, I start to divide that problem in very small tasks so I can focus on each one, but at the same time, taking into account the whole group of things.
Mm. I really like that term that you just, I've never heard that, positive anxiety. That's a really interesting way to think about it, because I think we all think of anxiety as being a deeply horrible thing. You know, nobody wants to have anxiety, but there is a positive effect of stress because it's making you aware. It's preparing you for the future, for, you know, something's about to happen and I can either take that stress and it can make me small and make me hide, or it can prepare me for action. So you're saying you are anxious, you acknowledge that you're anxious, and then you decide to take action. And are you saying that you take the energy of the anxiety and move it, it moves you forward?
Yes, it's what keeps me going. I mean, it's not the only thing that keeps me going, but it's like the thing, it's like the carrot that I have in front of me. Say, okay, I need to keep moving because if not, it's going to be more complicated. So, and at the same time, I say, well, it's a new opportunity to learn something new. It's a positive anxiety / excitement that something that is unknown when I get to learn something new. It happens to me that sometimes I go passing through the success phase and then go to the stagnation phase and that is when you start learning something and everything goes smoothly. And at some point you feel like you're not improving, that there is a task that you cannot resolve and it takes you more time than you think it should be taking you. And that's when you start feeling frustrating, question your career and everything. And the thing is that dealing with those insecurities in the beginning, for me, was something very hard to overcome. I felt that I knew so little that I knew that it was difficult. But at the same time, I was starting to stop enjoying programming. And that was not good. But I knew that it was an effort that was worth doing. So I kept going. I took a deep breath. And one day I started to say, okay, let's see what works for me. What it works for you maybe does not for me and vice versa. But I started to look for a methodology that helped me. And the first one that I found was to understand that it's something that you don't learn over the night, that it is a process, that it takes time. So I started talking to people. I started to be open, like, hey, sometimes I have no idea what I'm doing. How do you do this? What do you think about this that I'm doing? And start feeling more open about that. Like, hey, sometimes I don't know. And a lot of people were like, yeah, that happens to me too, and that's fine. Mm. Yeah, it's like I started to understand that there is a big game of insecurities sometimes in this profession, and I assume that in many professions they are too. That is like the superhero developer. And at the end of the day, we are all people, and we are all learning and trying to do our best. And it was really good for me to start talking with people, because very soon I could notice that I was feeling was much more common than I thought, that a lot of people were having the same feeling. So it's like, it's not your fault. It's not just you. Programming is hard. So yeah, and it's good to start having fun at being bad at learning, like looking at stuff that I did months or a few years ago and say, oh, well, I have improved. And that's a really good thing. It's like we don't only learn from success, but we also learn from failure. I learn a lot from failure, I have to say. So it's a good thing.
I often say that we should fail fast and fail often, right? And if you fail very, very fast, then you're doing a great job.
Yes, yeah.
One of the things I also liked about your talk was that you said that you started to respect your own learning pace. And I really like that. Rather than beating yourself up about not learning fast, you are learning about yourself and you're understanding how you learn and how fast you learn, and actually formally respecting the pace at which you learn, and then using that pace to set yourself up and prepare your lists of how you're gonna learn.
Exactly. Yes. I remember a few years ago when I started coding, I was like, no, I need to do it fast. If I do it fast, it means that I'm good. And then I think the reducing that fast pace, it came with years of work experience. I guess that life experience, when you get older, you sometimes become more patient with many things. So yeah, it's like I started to notice that being going so fast in learning, one, wasn't helping me to learn properly, and two, it was being harmful for myself, for my mood, for my health, because sometimes I was staying late at night and then waking up early to go to work the next day with all the stress of having a pending task. And I started to say, okay, this is my learning pace. I'm going to respect that. Of course, at the same time, trying to do everything that I need to do. But when it's about learning new things, I try to respect and getting to know myself a bit more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, being able to know yourself and what your, not just what your limitations are, but what the things you're good at are, can set yourself up for success. Like, I know what time of day I need to learn. I know when I'm a good learner, when I'm not. I know when to walk away. That was a huge thing for me.
Yes.
Because I think we are taught as programmers that we should work late into the night, and you know, you should somewhere at 12 hours or 16 hours of straight coding, there's a moment that will happen. And no, there isn't. Sometimes you just have to say, okay, it's 3 p.m. and I just cannot work anymore. I'm going to go for a walk because I'm done.
Yes, yes, absolutely. Yeah, for example, I know that in the evening and at night, I can't. It's like my brain does not work well. My most productive time is the morning and early afternoon. So I usually organize my days to do the most difficult task in the morning and the beginning of the afternoon, and then leave all the stuff that is already know how to do, that maybe it's repetitive or that I already is easier to do to late in the day. Yeah, that really organizes me a lot. It's really good to remember to look back from time to time and see what you have done and how to organize your work and see, all these things I have done them better in the morning, and maybe the evening is not a good time for me. But yeah, it's a really good thing that I learned how to do, and I feel proud of that, honestly.
No, I think you should feel proud of that, because it's an interesting thing that my wife has said before, that she feels sometimes that people let their lives happen by default.
Yes.
So if you don't decide, if you don't take control, then it will just happen, and whatever happens, happens. And then you say, oh, that happened, but it happened by default. If I simply do tasks whenever, I'm not going to necessarily have as good of an experience. But if I sit down and say, what am I good at? When should I do my expense reports? When should I do the hardest coding? And like you said, formally know when my time is, when my, what's it called? When you get into the groove.
Yeah.
You know, and then schedule everything that way formally. I don't think we sit down and think about that. I think we go to work, we check email, and then life happens and our day happens. And then we blink and then it's dinner time and then we do it again the next day.
Yeah, and that's, I don't know if that's good.
I'm pretty sure it's not good.
We need to do it, yes. There is a part that is real, work pay the bills, that's true. But yep. At the same time, we need to find time to have fun. For example, for me, it's start to find some side projects or a thing that I'm interested in do little demos for myself in CodePen where I can learn something new that I know that I don't have a deadline, but I can take my time and enjoy that much more. Another thing that I do a lot is to read about new topics when I'm commuting to work. It's a time that I have for myself to do that. So that's always really good.
Yeah. And some people like the side projects, myself. I mean, that is energizing. Mm-hmm. And other people, they code all day. And the last thing that they want to do is code later. So for them, it's disconnecting completely.
Yes, I have periods of time that I'm like that. I have to admit that I'm much more like that than having side projects all the time. Mm-hmm. There is a thing that, you need to have side projects, work on open source and all that. And it's perfect. It's amazing. Yeah, but it's also good to say, well, I'm going to be honest with myself. Now I'm not feeling like doing it. So I'm going to take a few weeks for myself. It's also good to recharge. Mm-hmm. For me, it's not about stopping and feeling lazy. It's more about taking some time to recharge so then you can be better.
Your code is powerful, and so are you. And when you consider the reach of your code, it's clear that to deliver quality code, you must also deliver secure code. So where can you start? A first step is educating yourself on basic secure coding principles and beginning to put these principles into practice every day. VeraCode's Secure Coding Toolkit is your go-to resource for all your secure coding needs. The benefits of the toolkit include learning best practices for secure coding, understanding how to secure your DevOps environments, and learning to combat the most common software vulnerabilities. Stay secure and download this valuable asset today at veracode.com/toolkit. That's veracode.com/toolkit.
And another thing that you do to recharge is do community work. You organize conferences and you get people together so that they can learn as well. And does that help you recharge?
Yes, a lot. I mean, it was in 2016, I organized with Eva Ferreira. I know that you have her talking here on the podcast a few weeks ago, and she explained the whole 2018 edition. When we organized the first one, the 2016, it was completely new. For example, for me, I have never even organized a huge party. I was organizing a 300 people conference. So yeah, it was quite a lot. And yeah, we have, the economy in Argentina fluctuates a lot. So it was quite hard to get sponsors, to pay for flights, accommodation for speakers, but it was so good. And the main thing that we wanted to do was to have a really low price because here, I know that conferences here in the US are usually $500 or maybe more, maybe a bit less, but we really wanted from day one, whatever we said, we want to keep it under $100 because I know that that's the most that people might be able to pay here. Mm-hmm. So we not only kept the ticket very low, that also led to try to get all the money from sponsors, but also we wanted to give scholarships to people who are in secondary school, that means between 16 and 18 years old, who are interested in programming, want to give them a giveaway free tickets for them. And that was amazing because you could see a lot of kids that were just starting really early to code and seeing their idols speaking on stage. And that was amazing. And for me, it was also really a really good thing because, for example, I started writing CSS because of Harry Roberts, CSS Wizard Rye, if you know him. And he was, I remember when I started coding in CSS, I was watching his videos and talks and blog posts. I was like, wow, I would really like to go to a conference and see this guy speaking on stage. So, well, I could not go to England or any other country, so I organized my own conference and I invited him to speak.
That's pretty cool. So you go from someone who you idolize in the space to working with them.
Yes, yes. It was something, a really cool experience. But yeah, I think that the best part of the organizing CSS Conf Argentina was to give the space to everyone to learn. In my opinion, it's like, well, for example, I didn't go to university to learn how to code. I got a degree in graphic design and web design, but not like computer science. So everything that I have learned is because someone took the time to teach me something, to explain something to me. And that's something really valuable. And I really wanted to give back that.
One of the other things that you said is that you use chaos as an opportunity to learn something new. It sounds like organizing a conference in a difficult economy when you've never, I love that you've never organized a party. it sounds like an opportunity that you could either panic and not do it, or you could turn that positive anxiety into something successful. Do you do the same thing when you find a chaotic code base?
Yes, absolutely. I try to organize. For example, I usually work on very long-term and large-scale projects. And usually it's a really big challenge for me, but I gotta say that it's one of my favorites. I love thinking steps ahead when it comes to work and when you work on a large-scale project, and especially in long-term ones, you really need to think ahead. So yeah, that gives sometimes some anxiety in terms of how is it going to be? How much is going to change? But I'd like to, after a few years of experience on this, I say, okay, I know that things change. I know that what you have in the beginning is not going to be that. So it's like I start thinking a few steps ahead. It's like I cannot work with my mind on a single feature. I try to think everything as a group, mm-hmm. and from there start asking, looking at the bigger picture, start asking myself questions like how much is it going to change, if it's going to be, for example, a localized project or not. Because, for example, we know that they usually give you the design, everything in English, and that you need to localize it to German or Finnish, which are really long languages, and mm-hmm. All the design breaks. So for me, it's about organizing all that, thinking a few steps ahead. And yeah, it happens to me that I have lost count how many times I start writing a new CSS for a project. And then I was repeating to myself like some sort of mantra. Yeah, this time it will be really tidy. I will write CSS, cool CSS like the cool kids do. Of course, especially this is my favorite one. Of course, I'm going to notice when my code base gets messy. Yeah, duh. But no, you don't. So what I'm trying to start doing is to start really pay attention to that when things start to get messy. And what I do for that is, yeah, usually happens two things. One is how much the project can change in an unexpected way. That means the client decided to take a different direction, a new design direction. And with that, we can think a few steps ahead. And then regarding code, based on that, we can think of how we can maintain that. So usually every time that I start a new project, I always like to start thinking at the elements it has. Then it will go for the layout. Then it will look for how it will look on different platforms, mobile devices, tablets, etc., etc. And I start asking myself questions like, how is the typography, the font size, the font family they use, how is the layout, how is the color palette? Because if I start thinking from that from the very beginning, I can start organizing my CSS, my files. It's like, okay, all the part of layout is going to be here. All the part of font sizing is going to be there. It's like I go from that general aspect of the whole project to a particular one. I think that for me, organizing a messy code base is about, yeah, taking a look at the whole picture, but at the same time, be really aware of all the small parts of it so you can put them all together and have something as tidy as possible.
Mm-hmm. I wonder sometimes why I feel like I'm a good back-end developer and I can mm-hmm. organize things in functions and break things down like you've described. But inevitably, my CSS ends up being pretty when it starts and then chaos at the end. You know, it just falls apart. Do you think that people are not considering CSS and their front ends like in a formal way? Should I be breaking things up into functions more and smaller pieces?
Yes, since I started using SAS a few years ago, I started to have a more programmatic approach on CSS, like mm-hmm. dividing components, doing functions, and that actually helped me a lot to learn more JavaScript. So, I think that many people consider CSS like, it's what it gives the color and the style of the font and some modules and that's it, but the thing is that it's easy to write, but hard to maintain later. So it's good that you're also organized and put a lot of thought on that because it's also an important part of the website. Yeah. It happens a lot that you start a project and you have a really nice class that does a lot of things and is super reusable, and then your project starts changing and that class is not that great anymore, and you start overwriting and adding more code. And we all know that when we write a line of CSS, we are like, oh no, let's not touch that one, let's not remove it. You never know what other part of the website can affect. So it's like and that way we start adding more and more content. That's how it usually gets messy.
Yeah, I think sometimes that back-end developers, as we start moving ourselves into the front-end, we start, for lack of a better term, we start to trivialize what we think front-end development is like, and then we make a small change, and we make a small change, and we forget the cascading part of cascading style sheets. Mm-hmm. And we think that it's just a little bit of markup here and there, but it's an entire programming language with formal functions and like SAS maps and things like that. And I think that I, as a back-end developer, I assume it's simpler than it is, and I end up hurting myself and I create chaos rather than remove chaos.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think that happens to me too. I'm not a back-end developer, but that mm-hmm. also happens to me. But
that's good.
Yeah, I think that CSS is a little bit underestimated sometimes. Mm. Yeah, that happens a lot. It gives you a quick lesson very fast because it gets really messy. And when you need to touch something of that code base again, you're like, oh no, what have I done? So yeah, it happens a lot for me. I try to be very mindful of the naming conventions and the file structure that I use, because it really helps me to know where every style lives. It happens many times that I don't want to simplify styles because we are afraid of changing a style that it could be used somewhere else, but we don't know where. And just in case, we don't touch it and we keep adding more specificity to the styles. And that also contributes to have a messy code base. So yeah, many times what I do is to start dividing. There is an approach called functional CSS that is doing small classes that do one thing and they do it well. For example, we have a text, for example, naming, that we can create a class that is text blue. But what happens if tomorrow the client or the designers decide to change that text to red? That class won't be usable anymore. But in the case that class is only applying a color, you just replace the class for another one with a better naming, maybe. Mm-hmm. and that can also help. It's about those small things, about being mindful. I think that if we stop a little bit and every time that we write CSS, we write it for thinking steps ahead, thinking if it's going to be easier to maintain, if it's going to be a problem in the future or not, instead of just writing for the sake of adding color and layout to the components of the page, it will help a lot to have a cleaner code base.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'll be sure to add information about functional CSS to the show notes. There's some really interesting things, because when I learned CSS, first we started with inline styles, and yes. then we moved it all into an external style sheet, and then we made a bunch of little utility classes like, you know, Bootstrap, and we would mm-hmm. you'd say div class, and then you'd have and all this information. And then people said, no, it should be like object oriented. You should have like a style called dot user or .flight. And people are basically going back and forth trying to figure out what's the correct way to write CSS that scales to really large sites. And I know that you work on big sites and it can be really challenging.
Yes, it is. This discussion about object-oriented CSS or IT CSS or using a BEM methodology, I honestly don't think that it's a right or wrong way to do it. I think that the best methodology that you can use is the one that suits you and your project, and every project has different needs. So it's not that, well, maybe what works for you in one project won't work for me on another one. And it's mm-hmm. good to, for me, the most important thing is to have a talk with the rest of your colleagues, if you're working on a team, and also the designers, the clients, the producers, to have a better understanding of the project. So we can see how we can scale, and from that, we can create a better methodology on CSS for this.
Interesting. So you would use one methodology on one project and then an entirely different one on another?
Yes, I have. Yeah.
Okay, that's good to know. It's interesting. Perhaps I was naive and I assumed that one size fits all and that one day we would solve CSS and we'd know that this is the right way for everything.
I mean, I have my preferences. If I need to pick a preference, it's going to be ITCSS, where I have many components and go for a very general aspect to a very particular one. That will be my main preferences. But I have worked on other projects where a BEM approach, block element modifier, was more suitable for that project. So I decided to use that. Maybe it wasn't my favorite approach, but it was the one that was working, and it ended up working well.
Mm-hmm. So ITCSS is a managed CSS architecture from CSS Wizardry, correct?
Yes, exactly.
And then what was the other one you said? BAM?
BAM, Block Element Modifier.
Block Element Modifier. And I'm going to make sure that we've got links to all of this for people to go and explore.
Oh, amazing.
Fantastic. Well, it's been so nice chatting with you today. I really appreciate your time.
Yes, thank you for giving me the chance to talk here. I really enjoy it.
We've been chatting with Lourdes Montano. This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.